Thanks for your beautiful music this morning. It's wonderful. On a cold day, a snow day, we're pretty close. We just need a little snow. But glad you're here today. Today we're going to do something kind of different. This week and next week, we're going to have a discussion with a leader in the marketplace who's living out their faith. And today we're going to be talking with Liza Lucer, who Liza runs a significant marketing, public relations, branding firm. We're going to hear more about that and all she does, and works all over the country and all over the world. And then next week, John Davis is going to be here, and John is head of services. What's it called? Public services, I think, for the state of Mississippi. He handles all the welfare programs, all the Social Security kinds of programs, all the food stamp programs, all the places where people are in greatest need in Mississippi. Has a gigantic budget of several billion dollars, and he's the guy in charge of the whole thing. He's an alum of Belhaven. So he'll be here next week, and unfortunately, I won't be here next week. I'm going to get some surgery on this hand and see if I can get it fixed so I can shake hands with you again when you graduate and all that good stuff. So I won't be here next week, but our dean will be leading that, our provost will be leading that discussion. But today we're going to talk with Liza and learn about her world and what she does, and hopefully God will speak to you during this. Would you welcome her to the platform? Come on, and let's talk some. You've been here before. You spoke in chapel a couple of times, mm-hmm. I think, in the past. But today we're going to do it a little different. Just talk about what you do.
This is much more fun.
Yeah, so we want to see inside your life. You run a big, huge agency. It's a PR agency. It's a branding agency. I'm not sure. Help us understand exactly what you do and what your business is all about, and how do you even label yourself?
Okay, sure. The CeeLo Agency is a global brand development company. We specialize in the traditional form of advertising, public relations strategy, crisis management, all things digital, from social media, web development, and then we also help companies win targeted contracts, to whether it's part of the military or Pentagon or you know, on an international basis. We just help them try to grow their company and position their products and services in the best light possible so they'll be purchased.
And so you have a bunch of employees, a few employees, you have offices here, you have offices other places. Tell us how the whole thing's structured.
We're not huge, and in Mississippi we'd be considered the largest firm, but on an international scale, firms start at like $100 million and go up. So we would be considered a boutique firm. We're about a $26 million firm as far as the volume of work that goes through our company, but we primarily specialize in the aerospace defense industry. That's really where I do a lot. But Sanderson Farms, the only headquartered Fortune 1000 company in the state of Mississippi, is here. We have worked with them for almost 35 years, and different companies here. We're honored to be working with DHS with a program to help families stay together, and whether they need education or if they need rehab or whatever, it's something. The whole focus is to keep the families first. You probably heard of it. Is to keep those families together and to weather those storms and to become independent. So it has a lot of meaning.
Good.
We love working with.
I didn't know you were doing the Families First program.
Yeah.
That's John from next week, who oversees that.
Yeah.
And we're part of the Families First. They got a grant for $500,000 to do training for mm-hmm. people who are needing to find work.
So, well, it is a fabulous program, and John, I'll let John tell you all about it next week.
Yeah.
But yeah, he's a great man.
That's great.
Great man doing a good job.
But one of your specialties is this whole defense contractor thing, and that's aerospace. That's not your background. You did a Harvard MBA, and undergraduate was more in public relations, I think, was it? How did you get to be an expert in aerospace?
I posted something last week. I was in D.C. at a space transportation conference, And I just posted the lanyard that you wear, you know, so you can get in and out and everything. And I was there with a company out of Silicon Valley, a new company where instead of rocket boosters going into space, they catapult satellites into space. It's a really neat concept. So anyway, startup company. But I posted, I'm getting inside of my inner nerd right here. You know, it was so fun. And I said it started with my father and I when we watched Star Trek together, you know. But it's I've got that nerdy side to me, but we started working with Ingalls Shipbuilding on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. That's where it all started from. And the way that our company launched into the aerospace defense industry was there's another large, Ingalls was owned by Northrop Grumman, an international huge firm that manufactures everything in the defense industry and so many other things, but defense is really their focus. And then Raytheon is another huge manufacturer, global as well. They teamed together to try to win the largest defense contract ever awarded at that time and called us in to help position them as that team that to win. 4 years later, they won the contract. And then media, they were kind enough to invite us to their victory party in New Orleans, and they both stood up, both leaders of the company stood up and said, we invited one supplier, that's us, to attend this victory party, and we would not have won this contract without the CELO agency. And so after that, some of the media started writing about us, and people started calling. Yes, it's been great.
Something. Wow, that's amazing. That is amazing. But you did another really fun project back in 2008 of the presidential debate at Ole Miss.
Right.
And a lot of pressure and issues around how to manage the complexity of those questions during that time with Barack Obama and
John McCain. Mm-hmm.
So tell us how that project came about and what happened.
It was really... It's a year and a half process. You know, the university pitched and won the opportunity to hold the debate at Ole Miss. And the Presidential Debate Commission is in charge of the entire program, so they direct what's going on. But it took about a year and a half. We were hired to help position the university because there were 3,000 journalists that came to campus to cover the debate all over the world. And BBC, hands down, they were the best and most engaging group of people that were there. They were so excited to be there and felt like it was such a historic opportunity and great for the United States. We were hired to handle all the media, but the last time the number of media representatives were in Oxford had been about 50 years prior, and that was not so good of a time. And so Ole Miss wanted to display and to share out to the rest of the world who they are today. And so that was an important part of the debate for the university. And so they did that. It was in 2008, and some of you would remember that there was a huge economic crisis in September of 2008. It was the week of the debate. It happened on a Monday, and on Friday was the debate. And it was John McCain and Barack Obama. And so the Presidential Debate Commission requires you to be prepared to have a third candidate show up. So if somebody wanted to be part of that debate and they were running as an independent, they could run again. They could debate against the Republican, Democrat, and the independent. And but what you couldn't do is to have a debate with only one candidate. And John McCain, because of the crisis, said, I'm not going to come to this debate. And it was the first debate of the entire presidential campaign. And so he said, I need to handle this. And Barack Obama's response was, well, you know, when you're president, you got to handle a lot of stuff at one time. I'm showing up. I'll be there. And so he committed to come. John said, I'm not going to come. And then we had to figure out what to do because the presidential debate had the Gertrude Ford Center with all of their background. You'll notice if you watch a debate, the background's the same and everything. And it takes probably 2 weeks for all the media to fly in and get all the lighting up in the auditorium set up for a national broadcast feed, and then you have the journalists in the back. And so anyway, tons of time, tons of cable, incredible, and then John's not coming. And so we all look at each other, and I'll have to hand it to Chancellor Kayat. He's immediately, we had to have a response, and I was with him, and he said, we have prepared for an event on Friday night. Everyone is here for this event who needs to be and have committed for this event on Friday night, and we will have an event on Friday night. So that's what was feeding 15 minutes later on CNN or Fox News down at the bottom, that there will be an event. And so the chancellor said, it's the students. They prepared, his speechwriter prepared the students to come up with the questions and everything. It was going to be a town hall meeting in the square in Oxford with Barack Obama. I've never seen more engaged students at that point. They were so excited at the fact that they were going to get to run this thing and it was going to be broadcast all over the world. And then on Friday, on cue, on schedule, John McCain's advance team touched down and said, we're here. And so then we went to plan A. So plan B didn't happen. So, the behind the scene things is the fact that the students of Ole Miss were so sad because they were so excited to be able to do this town hall meeting with Barack Obama. But anyway, it became a great, it was a good debate and everything. And Tom Brokaw, the thing that excited us the most is that Tom Brokaw broadcast after that and said, you ask if Obama won the debate or Senator McCain won the debate, and he said, I think the individual or the group that won the debate was actually University of Mississippi. He said, I was here 50 years ago, and this is not the Ole Miss that I found now, and what a great job they've done. And so, of course, we were in the background going, yeah, it's great, we did our job. We were so excited. So anyway, it was a great event. And so if you ever have an opportunity to become part of a presidential debate or anything like that, I highly recommend it.
Now, it was significant for Mississippi because it was an international stage to change some of the stereotypes of Mississippi. But you did another project on stereotypes of Mississippi several years ago. We used to see them on signs when you drive off from the airport.
That's right.
We've used them in some of our marketing, mm-hmm. especially to people from California who have no idea what Mississippi's about mm-hmm. and what the stereotypes they might assume mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And it's a problem for all of us in Mississippi. How did that come about, and what was that campaign like?
The thing that really started it was we were, a journalist came from a blue chip publication, an investment publication from New York, flew down and was very condescending about everything about Mississippi whenever he was interviewing and going on tour at Ingalls. And so just snide remarks throughout the entire day, and they're really uncalled for. I mean, one joke, okay, everybody's fine about it and everything, but it was just all day long. And so whenever we put him on the plane and he went back, we thought, somebody really needs to do something here. It's unfortunate. And then Katrina happened. But at the very beginning, we came up with this three ads or three posters we thought would do. And this was just around the table talking. And so we thought, okay, what are the top three stereotypical things that people think about citizens from Mississippi or the state of Mississippi? And the first three things that popped up in our head was, let's say, we're uneducated, we're poor, and we're racist. And so we took those three and talked through them and did a little bit of research and everything, and then found out some really great things. And so the first ad that we came up with was, yes, we can read, and a few of us can even write, We found out that Mississippi had more Pulitzer Prize-winning authors than any other state in the nation. And then, with we're poor, we said, yes, we wear shoes, and some of us even wear cleats. We have more NFL greats, the Walter Paytons, the Brett Barbs, the Jerry Rices, Eli Manning, from Mississippi that reached that level of performance in their careers. We had more than any other state in the nation. Then we thought about, okay, so we're racist. And we came up with no black, no white, just the blues. And the Delta and the mastery of the talent that came from Highway 61 that influenced the music, the world in music. And, the Rolling Stones attributes the name of Rolling Stones to Muddy Waters. That was one side of the song that he wrote and something that he recorded. And so we have so much good about Mississippi. And then Katrina hit. We needed a message. My husband was on a flight with a 12-year-old from Connecticut. They were going to Atlanta. He was flying in from Washington. And they were going to Atlanta. And he started talking, and the 12-year-old said, talked about a southern dialect, and he said, you really do kind of talk funny. So my husband's actually from Alabama, not Mississippi, so he had that kind of dialect. No, I'm joking. But anyway, they started talking, and so, but the boy innocently asked, do you see the KKK walk, or march in your city all the time? And do you really hate all black people? And and it really broke Rick's heart to hear a private school educated, but 12-year-old and innocent enough to ask the questions that nobody else would ask, those questions. And so he came back and we had this, this thought going and concept going, and he said, let's just do this, let's see what we could do. So after Katrina hit and we were able to ship, stuff because all the mail postage was demolished through Katrina. After mail was getting able to be distributed and everything, we sent a campaign of, I think, 12, actually, posters that were all written in that flavor to every elementary school, junior high school, junior college, four-year university, to help the students, and especially the children of Mississippi, understand that they are from a great state and that they can accomplish great and wonderful things. So that's what the campaign was about. And wow. The Today Show came down, and as far as our analytics, we've seen our over 80 million people have seen that. And that was in 2005. So it's been a while, and it still has a life to it.
That's amazing. I think God uses whatever we're good at professionally to put the wind of a calling into that that takes it so much farther than just the job, just the task, just the career. So how did you get this calling into this whole area of communications and helping people understand big ideas in ways that they can grasp?
I've always loved visually trying to communicate a message. And so that, as a little girl and when I was growing up, from drawing to going to high school and doing campaigns for the school and then going to college. And so I always had that love for what I do. From the journey of life, through a series of events, I wound up being independent at 15 and had the love of a beautiful aunt and uncle who took me in with their two girls to live with them. But then I worked. They were very they lived in modest means and everything. And I never wanted to be a financial burden to them. And but I had to put myself through school, so I figured out a way to earn money. I would save money. It was always important to me. tithed hands down. I was at the point, and still today would rather not eat than tithe, than not tithe. The most important thing, though, I think, is the fact that you earn the value of earning and working hard and being blessed by that and doing good work with your money to so that I was able to put myself through school. And I paid every dime. I mean, we're talking, toothpaste to close the doctor bills. But what it did was help me figure out a way to do a good work. And so that journey started really at 15. And then when I came here, I worked for the Clarion Ledger, and they gave me a map with a line around a certain area of the city and said, okay, go sell ads in that area, and that's your territory. And so I, my fear of approaching or talking to someone about their business and what they do and how I can help their business, after doing that, I was never afraid or timid about talking openly about how I could help another company do better and succeed.
That's cool. It's interesting how we can see our calling start to germinate early in life. Mm-hmm. You talked mm-hmm. about tithing earlier. I mean, Marilyn and I always did too. We gave 10% plus since the earliest time when we didn't have any money. And, if people wait till they give until they get money, they're never going to give. If it doesn't start early, you're not going to do it.
Yeah, so that's right.
That calling, though, evolved and developed. You didn't set out and say, well, I'm going to have one of the most significant agencies in aerospace. So how did you go from Clarion Ledger to all of this happening?
I think I believe God's gone before me, and I believe that God put everything into my heart that I'm doing. And if that changes tomorrow or this afternoon, I'll do something else. I'm not afraid of letting it go. When I felt the calling for me to start my own company, I prayed over it for about a year, and in my head, in prayers, debated with God that this was really what I was supposed to do, while I knew that was my passion and what I wanted to do. But I couldn't see how I could own a company and have a family. And my entire focus and my definition of success was to have a family and to provide well, I'm not saying with a lot of money, but to provide for my family. That's something I didn't have. So, usually you're a little more passionate about things like that. But the long story short is that with doing it, I couldn't see how I could manage having a family and children and running a business and everything. And but in faith, I went in the direction that I knew God was leading me to. And I was excited about it. I just didn't know how it's going to work out. And what I didn't realize is that I was really preparing a place for my husband. I mean, I met him 4 years later, and he was in Alabama in the same industry, and he came and joined the firm. And so we're celebrating our 31st anniversary, the 19th of March. And since we spend about 24 hours a day with each other, we say that we've been married 219 years this year. It's 31 years times 7 in dog years. We've been married a long, long time.
That's great. Yep. That's great. Can you do it all? I mean, what about everybody else who's thinking, yeah, I want that great career, but I also want the family, and I want other kinds of things to get the fullness of life. What has to give to make that happen?
I think you have to be able to, well, and if I can put it in really into your own words, to allow the winds of God to blow and through your life and sail. So I grew up on the coast. So when I read your book, The Long View, it just struck a chord in me. And that's really what I've tried to do all my life. And you visually describe to me what I've been trying to do and wanting to do. If you restrict what you allow God to do in your life, you're going to have a restricted life. If you allow for God to blow through and to open up those sails and use all the talent, all the wisdom that you've gained in life, and to blow that out, I mean, you are going to be able to do really, really great things. And so what has to give is my will, my own will, and my own sense of this is the direction I'm going in, and I'm not going to stop until I get there. The Lord has a different way, 9 times out of 10, than I've ever thought I would get to a point. He has a different journey for me. And so there are a lot of twists and turns and in life, but his timing is perfect. And so when I start feeling worked up about it's not going according to plan here, you know, what are we going to do, and how is this going to happen, I have to just take a breath and realize, you know, and give it and to confess to God that, Lord, I know your timing is perfect, and I trust you that your timing is perfect and according to your will. And I have to step back. So really, what my will has to give. And the most important thing about this is that, you know, you follow God's guidance and his direction. And some people may think that's really restrictive, but to me, it's the most freeing feeling in the whole wide world.
Absolutely, because when we give up the control and we trust God to do it, he does so much more
than
what we do, but it's usually very, very different. Mm-hmm. So now you're very visible about your faith. You've been chair of the Chamber of Commerce for Jackson, big position. You run your big, huge company. You're the big boss, and your husband works for you, which I like a lot. I think that's good. But because you are open about your faith, does that ever become a problem when you're trying to sell a defense contractor or a big brand or something when they don't understand faith? Where's the conflict come?
Well, I think the challenge is that, for instance, we work with an Israeli company, and I had to go through sensitivity training and that their company offers to all their employees and their suppliers, just not to inflict my faith upon others that have a different faith. And there's a high respect. I just hope that people see me and see God and the Word of God coming through me, not by what I say, but what I do. And I hope that that's the loudest part of it, of my testimony, is my action, my work ethic, and what I do for a living. And it's, you know, one good thing is that it's been great to find other fellow Christians in the aerospace defense industry. And you think about the military, the military really has a strong faith, and so that has been certainly a blessing. For those that do not want to hear anything about it, well, then that's a level of respect. You know, that's, I respect that, and we do business together. But the long-term 35-year relationships and everything have been bonded, I think, with God's hand on it because of our faith and being blessed of being part of each other's journey.
And how do you keep your faith vibrant and solid and balanced when you're being pulled a lot of different directions, you're spending an awful lot of time on the road, and a lot of jobs today now require people to be on the road, and I think for Christians it makes it difficult to keep life in balance and in control. How do you manage all that when you're dealing with all this stuff in your faith?
It's difficult. You have, you know, in our world, whenever we're traveling, and we have a rule, and usually women will travel together, men will travel together. We try to separate that. Sometimes we're as teams, and that's okay. But we travel as a team. We do not go off alone, and we do not have dinner with clients alone. It may be, you know, once or twice if it just has to happen, but as a rule, we're always together as a group, and that is really the kind of the Billy Graham rule that we have, that we try to live by, because what you don't want to do is for people to see you out or to see you engaged in a conversation and think something different So, you know, we just don't want to deal with that. But, you know, we're stronger as a team. We're better as a team. I had mentioned to you with the, you know, the Me Too movement and everything. My son lives in Washington, D.C., my daughter in L.A., and my son, when all of this was coming down, was working on the Hill for Marco Rubio, and I called him, and I said, whatever you do, do not get in the elevator alone with a woman. It, you know, you're on Capitol Hill, and so you're hearing all of this stuff coming down, and I said, do not be in a room alone. And he's going, mother, please. You know, he's a married man. I am a married man. I am not. And I said, no, it's just what people look like. But I really feel sorry for men right now, because I feel like every one of you are a potential target. So, and it's hard, especially being from the South, because we are kind of loving people. I hug, you know, now I do the side hug. And hey, how you doing? And, but it's, you know, it's hard to express your appreciation and love for one another and not yet touch. And so, and just, you know, really be careful. Now, on the other side of the continent, I called my daughter on the same day, and I said, don't you put up with that stuff. Don't you yell it from the mountaintop. You call it, you know, if anybody's messing with you, you know, bring them down. Yeah, don't deal with all that. So there's got to be a balance. But in the Bible, it says, excuse me, love your neighbor as yourself. You know, everything is so, it's already there, the way that we should act and what we should do. And so that mutual respect and love for one another, yeah, as you love yourself, should solve everything.
Yeah. And if you take the important barriers up to begin with, you know, getting those kind of situations.
That's right.
Me Too is great because we're exposing a whole bunch of creeps, and it's mm-hmm. it's sick how many are out there and how dominant it is in so many industries. And so let's keep that going. But at the same time, yeah, you've got to be smart so you don't get accused of something. The Billy Graham rule, right, which is now called the Mike Pence rule, mm-hmm. Works.
Right.
And
right,
it makes life a little harder, but I've always followed it, and I think it's important to do it.
So. It is. And again, when you're with people, I mean, safety in numbers, and it dispels so much. Yeah.
How do you get restored in your faith when you're running as hard as you are and traveling as much as you are and weekends, I'm sure, gone and some kind of stuff? How do you stay strong in the Lord?
Everywhere I go, I bring the Holy Spirit, you know, with me, and obviously, that's kind of a mental emotional thought that I do it. He's there wherever you are, so you know, it's not like I'm bringing him with me like a coat, but I feel like I'm wrapping him around me, you know, to be part of my life every day. So I do that in prayer. I do that at the office. I do it. I pray in my car to work. I you know, turn off the radio and I pray there. When I'm 30,000 feet in the air, sometimes I feel like, I've often said I can't think unless I'm 30,000 feet in the air. But that's a great time to put some headphones on and to download whatever devotional it is, or book, or just reading from the Bible is fabulous. And I do that in the hotel room. I am, before meetings, I am walking around my room with my hands up, and I'm asking God to guide us each day. I'm asking God to give us creative and strategic minds to exceed our clients' expectations, to go before us, to give us travel mercies, and to do a good work. Let us do a good work. And so I hope that spirit's in that hotel room for the next person who walks in right after I leave. But every day I remember why I'm here, what I'm doing, and it's hard. There's nothing, I don't want to sugarcoat any of it. It is so hard, and I know, I was telling Dr. Parrott, when I just can't breathe and think, okay, you know, one more, just take another step. When I am weak, he is strong, and I'm doing what I believe God leads me to do every day. I don't have yesterday, I don't have tomorrow, but I have today, so what can I do today that's according to his will and his wishes for me? today for his best. And I want his blessings and I want his favor. And I want, at the end of the day, to say I've contributed to make this world better or my family better than I found it this morning.
Thanks for, you've been transparent and open so we can kind of see into your life a little bit, and thanks for that. Thanks also for serving on our Board of Trustees. I really appreciate it. I know
when
you travel, it's hard, and you make that a priority because you care about this place. But for students who are getting ready to graduate, maybe this spring, maybe in a year, two, or three, going out to get that first job, you know, if you're starting all over right now, what you know and how to go get that, what's the practical advice to get going?
That's a great question. And to all of you, just a few things that come to mind, because we're inundated with resumes and we conduct interviews, you know, throughout just virtually every week. A few things I want to say are for you to walk into the your first interview prepared. Do not say, I am here to learn. I'm not hiring people to teach. I'm hiring individuals that I think have the potential to make my company better. That's what every employer is doing. They're trying to put a team together of talent, of skill set, to make the company more successful. Doesn't matter if it's a nonprofit, it doesn't matter if it's a Fortune 100 company, that's the goal. So do your homework, research their website, what they do, what they offer, and what you've been taught. You can bring reports, you can bring a brief, you can bring whatever you've written that might apply to the interview or to the company, so that you could possibly bring it out in the interview and say, hey, you're welcome to read this, and this is what I found when I was doing my research. It gives you an opportunity to ask a lot of questions. But yes, you can say, I'm a quick study and I look forward to learning about this company and how I can advance my career and how I can make this company more successful. But again, you're not there to learn. You're out of school now. You have a degree. So don't come in saying that. The other thing would be to, when you send your resume, everybody sends their resume online. And I receive emails going, I haven't heard anything. I sent my resume, you know, 2 weeks ago. Nobody's called me. Nobody's going to call you. You know, you have a truckload of resumes that are sitting on your desk, and no one has a face. I don't know anything about any of you all, and now I'm going to have to, you know, labor over reading through every resume that one might pop up and qualify for an interview. If you want this job, you go after it. You call them, you write a letter, the art of a handwritten letter or a personal letter, and then a phone call to say, I would like to have an interview. And you keep calling until they say, yes, you may have the interview, or no, you're never going to get one. And then you move on. But you're going to have to break out of all the online applications. It may be the first thing you have to do, but you have to find out and do some digging, call some people that might know individuals that work at a company, but get some names and get a contact. If it's the wrong contact, they'll give you the right contact to call. So again, don't expect them to call you. They're not going to do it. They have a job to do. Where getting a job is right out there, and that is your job, is to find your job. That's your 8 hour a day effort. My 8 hour or 12 or 16 hour a day effort is to do work, and to, when I can find the time, go through a couple of resumes that might surface to the top that we may want to talk to. So, you know, it's, you've got to do your work to try to get attention enough to get an interview, to secure an interview. And then once you get that interview, be prepared. Do your homework. Have a list of at least 10 questions that you want to ask them. And those questions should not be, do you get an expense account and a company car? Don't ever ask that question in an interview.
That's good. You know, one of the best techniques I know is to ask for a 3-minute stand-up meeting.
That's good.
I'd like to come and just hand a letter to so-and-so who's in charge of that hiring, and I'd like just a 3-minute stand-up meeting. I will not sit down, and I just want to hand this to them. Could I get on the schedule? And you can get in for that.
I love that.
Absolutely. Once you get in and show your smiling face, it's amazing what can happen. Mm-hmm. So thank you for this today. Thanks for sharing with us. We have a benediction we say together, and we're going to say it as a prayer for students who are getting ready to graduate, especially, and those who are starting to think about career preparation, that God will lead them. Let's share it together. No eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love Him. Have a great day.